Yes.
Thank you, Christina. Okay, so today I'd like to tell you about the sort of active topic that I've been working on since I've been here over the last week or so. And that's related to flow and phase separation of active spinners. Okay, so this is theoretical work which is inspired by an experiment and a simulation. And so the experimental side is work of Yuka Tabe in Japan, which I'll tell you about in just a moment. And so I've been working on modeling that with my former graduate student, Liana Lopatina, who's now at Los Alamos. And then the phase separation is inspired by simulations of Sharon Glotzer. Okay, so let's begin with the experimental side, right? So there's this series of experiments by Yuka Tabe at Waseda University in Tokyo and Hiroshi Yokoyama at our institute, the LCI, where they work with films, liquid crystal-like films of chiral molecules. Okay, so in experiment number one, they can say put a film of chiral molecules in a Langmuir monolayer, so it's on the surface of water. They are in a tilted phase, so something that liquid crystal people would call a smectic C phase, right, where the molecules are tilted like this. And as they change the humidity of the air, they can induce water transport, say, out of the subphase into the atmosphere. Okay, so there's a current of water moving upwards. And then because the molecules are chiral, that current induces a precession. So the molecules start to rotate around like this. Okay, so they're rotating around. If there were no boundary conditions, then everybody could be rotating around together. However, if there are boundary conditions on the edge of the film, then the molecules at the edge are pinned. They cannot rotate. Inside, they are still trying to rotate, and so the system builds up elastic energy. It builds up complicated patterns like what's shown here, say where there are stripes or rings in the molecular orientation, which show up when you put the picture when you observe with polarized light, right? Because these are birefringent molecules.
Sorry.
Please.
In the smectic phase, are the molecules fixed in space, or are they allowed to diffuse around?
They are allowed to diffuse around, but in this experiment, they don't diffuse around very much. Presumably because of the viscosity of the underlying fluid, right? That the coupling to the underlying fluid prevents them from moving very much, right? So in that situation, the situation with the pinned boundary conditions, you get these complicated looking patterns which have been investigated by the Japanese group, and Harold Piner and his collaborators have also worked on modeling these kinds of structures.
Are these structures static, or do they pulsate with respect to whatever the precession frequency of thing is? Or if I just look at it, it just stays there?
It winds up and then becomes static, right? And so the precession makes things wind up, okay, so it builds up elastic energy, right, like stretching a rubber band, right? And then at some point, the elastic torque, which acts against further rotation, cancels the torque coming from the precession, and then it becomes static. Now, there's a modified version of the experiment, number two, where they use freely suspended films, right? So instead of films that are on top of water, okay? And in that case, well, this is in response to Jose's question, right? In that case, you don't have the underlying water with a viscosity to prevent the motion. And so in that situation, when the molecules start precessing like this, it induces big currents. And so you get a big circulation of the liquid crystal moving around. In experiment number three, they can do the same kind of thing, but in a smectic A phase rather than a smectic C phase, right? So that means that instead of having molecules that are tilted like this, the molecules are standing vertically with respect to the film, okay? And then the precession just makes them want to spin about their long axes like this, okay? So there's no longer any optical signature of the spinning, right? There's no longer any winding up as there was in the previous case, but there is flow, right? And so in this case, as the molecules are spinning, it induces this current of spinning molecules circulating around, although less than in the smectic C case.
Where's the energy from for this circulating motion?
Well, it's driven. So the water is moving from one side to the other side based on a humidity difference that the experimenters impose. Right, and so that's the active side, which is driving the flow. A difference of temperatures or something, right. Okay, so that's the experimental half of the motivation. The simulation half of the motivation comes from the simulation that I found from the group of Sharon Glotzer at the University of Michigan that came out on archive a few months ago. They've done these simulations where they have a two-dimensional system composed of these bumpy disks, okay? And there are two kinds of bumpy disks. One kind wants to spin clockwise and the other kind wants to spin counterclockwise. And then they're free to move, they're free to rearrange themselves. And they run the simulations to see what happens. The remarkable thing to me is that in some cases they can start with a system that's well mixed, right, with these two kinds of spinners. Say when you have the rotation rate very low, and then if you crank up the rotation rate, then they phase separate. And so they make two different regions where the individual spinners are rotating around, okay? And then in some cases they can be fluid phase separated regions. In some cases they can be crystalline regions. And if they form a crystal, then the whole crystal can start to rotate in one way or another based on what's the predominant component within that region. Okay? Okay, Jose.
Was this inspired by an experiment?
Not that I know of. Well, and so Christina, you may know the background story for the simulation.
No, I don't know the background story for the simulation, but I don't think so. And the reason I say I don't think so is because we actually spend a lot of time trying to find some experimental way in which you could ask actually spinners to rotate in opposite directions,
right,
as opposed to all in the same direction,
right,
and we fail. I mean, we, you know, looking in the literature, but also thinking of ways of doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So I doubt it's described as experimental. Maybe, I don't know, because you can only do this in simulations, I think.
Right. So, Maya.
Sorry, I'm just wondering if you have, is it fixed rate or fixed flow?
I don't know. Yes, good question, and I didn't notice that.
It's overdamped, so fixed rate is fixed up in their simulation.
Yeah.
It's overdamped, so torque equal to rotation is fixed.
But they
interact
with each other, so is that
if the torque interacts with something else, then it's not obvious.
Yeah. So individually, it's fixed
individually.
That is fixed rotation, but then you have the interaction.
Okay. All right. So, To the best of my knowledge, the experimenters and the simulators are not aware of each other on this thing, although I could be wrong about that.
Can your system rotate in different directions?
Can it rotate? No, but I propose she could do it. She could do it. She could make a racemic mixture of the two enantiomers. Yes. The chemists can synthesize right or left-handed versions of the same molecules, right? And then they presumably would be mixed when there's activity, no drug.
In that system, so you say that the rotation is driven by some humidity gradient or temperature gradient or something like that?
Yes.
So it is effectively sort of like applying a torque on each one of these rods?
That's my understanding, right. So that's the claim I'm making right up here, right?
Okay. The reason I'm asking this is because I think in terms of the flows that this rotating thing would create, it does make a difference whether this is a torque monopole or a torque dipole, right? Mm-hmm. And that's an issue that people have. Because, like, for instance, people have studied these little magnets confined, say, at an oil-water interface and get them to rotate by applying magnetic fields. Mm-hmm. So it's like a torque applied to each little magnet, so that creates a certain type of flow field.
Okay.
But things like proteins, rotating protein motors in membranes, they actually create torque dipoles, so they generate different kind of flows from the magnetic beads. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering which category was this. But maybe you'll tell us.
Maybe I don't even quite understand the question. Right? I mean, my understanding
is like, in the context of swimmers, that people are always talking about whether there is a force, a net force on the swimmer, or the swimmer applies a net force to the fluid, or applies a force dipole. And the flows generated are different. Mm-hmm. So it's a similar idea.
My understanding is that it's the monopole here.
I think it is, but
I'm not sure if I can prove that. But that's how I would understand what's going on here. Okay, so the specific questions here are wanting to make sure I understand correctly that the driving due to water transport is something analogous to activity, as you were saying, right? And then suggesting that there could really be this correspondence between experiment and simulation if the experiment used a mixture of right and left-handed molecules. More general side, I'm just interested in learning about how the driving or activity can induce flow, and then beyond that, how it can induce a phase transition, right? How it couples to the statistical mechanics. Right. So on the flow side first, right? Okay, here, my favorite textbook, right, for learning about how the flow works in liquid crystals. Okay, so what I learned from that textbook, right, is that there is a system, right? There's a fairly mechanical procedure for generating equations of motion, which people have been using in liquid crystal hydrodynamics for many years. It's something that I didn't really learn until I got involved with this. And so my version of this thing that people have been doing for years is based on Lagrangian dynamics, right? To say that you can derive equations of motion by working with a Lagrangian, as we teach students in classical mechanics, right? So, which is kinetic minus potential energy. And then there's a Lagrangian equation of motion like this. If there is dissipation in addition to conservative forces, then you can add that to the formalism by putting in the Rayleigh dissipation function, which is half the rate of energy dissipation. And then the Lagrangian equation of motion gets modified like this to include derivatives of the dissipation function. Okay, and if there are constraints, that's fine. They can go over on the right side of the equation like that, okay? So this is an attractive way of thinking about dynamics for people like me who are accustomed to thinking about free energies and Landau theory for free energies, right? Because if you've grown up by constructing free energies, which include all the sort of symmetry allowed terms, then here you can say, oh, no problem. Well, here I'll construct a kinetic energy and a potential energy and a dissipation function, which include all the symmetry allowed terms. Okay, and put them all in with some arbitrary coefficients. And then, well, instead of just minimizing a free energy, I can just take this bunch of derivatives and get an equation of motion that way. Okay, that works. It works for an ordinary fluid, for example, if you want to say there's just a generalized velocity field like this. And then there's a kinetic energy density and, say, a constraint of incompressibility. And then for the dissipation function, you can say, well, what modes dissipate energy, right? Well, a velocity by itself doesn't dissipate energy because all the molecules can just move together, right? So only velocity gradients can dissipate energy. And in fact, not all velocity gradients can dissipate energy, because if everything is just rotating together, that's a velocity gradient, but there's no friction of molecules against each other coming from that uniform rotation, right? And so the mode that can dissipate energy is this shear rate, right, that comes from the symmetric combination of velocity gradients. Okay, and so you can then say, well, with this tensor that dissipates energy, the trace of the tensor squared could be something that goes in the dissipation function. And then if I go follow that Lagrangian equation of motion procedure, right, then I can derive this equation of motion for the velocity field, which is Navier-Stokes. Right, so you guys all knew that already, but you're just being polite to me. Okay, please, Annette.
This includes the convective
moment. I guess. Don't ask me that question.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Is this a Lagrange?
Lagrange. Presumably, it's the same Lagrange, right? Who did those things?
I
right.
was just
okay.
curious.
Okay. Right. Okay, so now, if it's not an ordinary fluid, if it is a pneumatic liquid crystal, okay, then the hydrodynamics is a little bit more complicated because you have to think about the coupling between orientation and flow, right? You would want to say, well, what happens if the molecules are rotating? Right, like this, okay? Is that a mode that dissipates energy? Right? And it depends on what the fluid is doing, right, alongside the liquid crystal, right? If the fluid is staying still and the liquid crystal molecules are moving like this, or rotating like this, that dissipates energy, right? If the fluid is moving around and the liquid crystal molecules are not rotating, that dissipates energy, right? If they're going together, right, if this is like a big phonograph record turning at 33 RPM, right? Students don't know what I'm talking about, right? There used to be a way of encoding music on sheets of plastic. Never mind. Okay. But anyhow, if it's all turning around, right, and these things are all rotating at the same rate, right, then there's no energy dissipation for that, okay? So we can put that into this kind of a formalism, all right? And so now there's a generalized coordinate, right, which is the pneumatic director field, okay? There are generalized velocities, which are the flow velocity and the derivative of the director, okay? And each of those things can go into the kinetic energy, all right? And then you can put in constraints like incompressibility and the director staying a unit vector. And I can put in the modes that dissipate energy, like the shear rate that I had before, and then the relative rotation of the director and the background vorticity of the fluid, all right? The difference between those things. Question?
Yes, your modes of dissipate energy, is this something you just guessed based on the symmetries, or is there a more precise way of finding all of them?
Harold, what's the answer to that one?
Dissipation is always phenomenological.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Right, right, okay. I think so. Okay, so it's so compared to the background rotational flow like this, okay. And so then if we say, you know, there are these modes that dissipate energy, which are a tensor and a vector, right, then we can construct what goes into the dissipation function, right, based on how you can contract the tensor and vector, say at second order in these two rates, right, to make a scalar. Okay? So you can have this kind of a term, right, which is the ordinary viscosity term, like I had before. Right? You can have anisotropic versions of it with the director, okay. You can have this relative rotation rate squared, right? That's another way of making a scalar. Or you can make this kind of a cross term, right? So for people who, as I said, are accustomed to making free energies with all these different sorts of contractions, then hey, do it in a dissipation function, all right? And so those things can all enter into the dissipation function with some coefficients. And there are conventional names for these coefficients in the field of liquid crystal hydrodynamics. And so this makes one way of deriving Erickson-Leslie theory for liquid crystal dynamics. You know, as an example of what we could do with that, you know, a classic problem with liquid crystals is shear alignment. That is, if you have an imposed shear flow like this, this tends to align the pneumatic in a particular direction, okay? And we can work it out by saying, okay, well, what's the kinetic energy? Let's say there's no potential energy. What's the dissipation function in this formalism, okay? And then the Lagrangian equation of motion automatically gives an expression like this with a steady state solution, okay, that says that the favored orientation of the liquid crystal is given by the ratio of two viscosity coefficients. It's a remarkable thing that it's an alignment of the liquid crystal that comes from viscosity rather than coming from energy.
This is a question of how you derive your equations. If you derive it in the Eulerian picture, it's clear that this is a reactive flow parameter. It's a reversible, the whole stuff is reversible. You can forget completely about dissipation and you find this flow alignment. This comes from the Lagrangian picture,
which is used in this derivation. Well, that's interesting. I'd like to learn more about that. Maybe you can tell me afterwards. Thank you. So Peter Olmsted, who's going to be coming here shortly, is that right, Christina? Yes, right. So he did a lot of work with this concept of shear alignment back when he was a PhD student, and he had the shear alignment as a variable in a phase diagram. So maybe he'll tell us more about that when he comes. All right, so that was, case two was the pneumatic liquid crystal, right, which has the spin and director field, right? But in between the case one for ordinary fluid and case two for a pneumatic liquid crystal, right, is case 1 3/4, right, which is what happens if you have particles that have a spin but no orientation, right? So you could imagine with point-like particles like this, or you could imagine if it's a smectic aphase, right? If these are all rods sticking out of the plane here, okay? And these things could be spinning, and they could be rotating like this. They could be flowing, okay? And so now, you know, we can do the same kind of argument where there's a kinetic energy density involving both of those things, and there are these two modes that dissipate energy, the shear flow and the relative rotation, spin with respect to the background. And so then there's a Rayleigh dissipation function, which can include two of these kinds of terms. And so this could make a theory for, for spinning things that have no orientational degree of freedom. Okay, so that then is what I want to use for a model for this Yukatabe experiment, right? This is what I want to say in her smectic A experiment, right? The one where you have water transport inducing spin, okay, and inducing overall flow, okay? I can set that up like this, right? If you were doing the experiment in a simple rectangular geometry, can put in the kinetic energy density, the dissipation function density, and then work out equations of motion, as I've shown you, right, which have the ordinary viscosity and this rotational viscosity, okay? And now I have to add something that's the torque coming from the activity, from the water transport, from one side to the other, okay? So what I want to do here is to say there is a torque which is acting on the rotational velocity, acting on the spin like this. I think this is what Christina means by a monopole, though correct me if I'm wrong about that.
What I had in mind was, I mean, you're not looking at this, was the kind, was the hydrodynamic interactions among these rotors,
mm-hmm.
which, and the difference would be, now imagine having a bead driven by an electric field, so mm-hmm. it's a point force in a fluid. It generates a certain type of flow profile, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you actually have a particle like a swimmer, which yields the force dipole in the fluid, the flow profile is different. So the bead is like the force monopole, the other one is the dipole. And
okay.
What you have here, yes, it's like a monopole, yes, but you're not really looking at what I would call hydrodynamic interactions anyway. So
he would be
okay. Solved for omega. Right, right, but I don't think.
If I solve, well, and as I'm about to.
Okay, so right. this would be what I would call a monopole.
Yes, indeed. But before I go on to solve for it, I wanted to raise the question, right, of what's the right theoretical justification for putting a term like this in, right? So I'm sorely tempted to derive a term like this from the Lagrangian kind of formalism by saying either I'm taking a derivative of a dissipation function, or I'm taking a derivative of the free energy, right, acting in the role of a potential energy. But which is it, right? I mean, I could say there's a dissipation, which is like some external water flow thing times the spin, right? And then if I take the derivative with respect to the spin, That gives this kind of term, which goes in the right place, right? Alternatively, I can say there's something in the free energy, some sort of effective potential energy, which is a water flow coefficient times how much the angle has wound up, right? Either way, I get the same answer, which is like this. This would be kind of a weird thing, right? Because there isn't really an angle that's an observable degree of freedom here, but formally it does give the right thing, right? And so I'm a little bit confused on the formalism point of whether to introduce this coming from a dissipation function or free energy or something else. That's not a horrible thing in this problem, because it's better to have two ways of deriving something than no ways of deriving something. But it will be a problem later on. Okay.
So what are you think theta is observable?
It's not observable?
It's classical quantity.
Well, no, I don't mean as a quantum mechanical thing, right? I just mean that you have, say, objects like a cylinder, right, which are spinning, right? And you could look down on them and say, oh, I see that they're spinning. But it's hard to look down on them and say, well, now theta is 10 degrees and later it's 20 degrees, right?
There's a model or something, and see what's going on. There are other experimental techniques you could get to such an angle where you could actually see sequence some sort of one side of the molecule fluorescent or something.
Well, for an individual molecule, yes, but for the ensemble of molecules, right? If I'm coarse graining, I'm guessing that I have no long range order in the orientation of the molecules, right? So I've got some molecules like this, some like this, some like this, some like this, right? And there's an ensemble like that within my square 10 nanometers, say, and if I wait a second, right, they're all rotating, but nothing has happened to the distribution of orientations, right? It's still the same flat distribution of orientations as it was previously. So that's the sense in which I'm thinking it's not observable. Yeah.
Sorry, this got me more confused. Is theta a collective variable, or if it's had some meaning, let's say you had given your particles, let's say a spin or an axis to actually follow the individual angle, then would this theta be the collective one?
Yeah. If I were doing the symmetric C case, right, or the pneumatic case, right, then I would say there's some local orientation which is changing in time, right? And it's a local orientation of the molecules that are in some coarse grained region around that position, right? And so that would be no problem for the symmetric C or pneumatic formalism, right? It's only that now when I'm applying it to something like this that has circular cross sections, that there isn't really a theta, there's only a theta dot, right? There's only a spin rate that not and not an orientation. Okay, please go ahead.
Similar question. This is a chiral object, right? In principle, there's a sort of, I think, like variable chiral down. You could write theta. It does make sense to talk about theta.
I'm not sure what you mean by the Ising-like variable. I mean, these things are all uniformly chiral. I'll deal with the mixture of chiralities in just a couple minutes. Okay, but these are all uniformly chiral. But I'm not sure how that gives like a reference point for this notation. Okay. All right. So, and anyhow, if you believe either of these derivations or some other derivation for such a term, okay, then we can solve the equations, right? And then there's a steady state solution for what's the spin rate and for what's the velocity profile, right? And so you can get everybody spinning like this, and you have a gradient of the velocities, and you know there is still some dissipation because the spin is not perfectly matched to the gradient of velocities, but those things partly cancel each other out. Just depending on the relative magnitudes of these two viscosity coefficients. Okay.
Just as a related comment,
please.
You can consider your theta as a gauge variable, so that the, it itself does not matter, but its derivatives are physical.
That's a very interesting point. I'd like to learn more about it afterwards, maybe. Okay, that's great. All right, so that's my story about the experiment, right? So this is what I think we understand for the Yukatabe experiment, where the molecules all have the same handedness, okay? And so now I want to proceed to the simulation where the, not molecules, but particles, are a mixture of right and left-handed units, okay? And where they have the capability of phase separating. Okay. And so the question is how to combine the active rotation with what we know about phase transitions. What we know about phase transitions on the sort of continuum elastic or hydrodynamic type theory. Okay. So the variables here are going to be the chiral composition, you know, the enantiomeric excess locally of how many more right-handed versus left-handed units there are, and the local spin and the local flow velocity. Okay, so in order to do that, I want to make an analogy with a hypothetical equilibrium statistical mechanics problem, which is more familiar, right? So suppose in a hypothetical equilibrium problem, we had two chiral components, okay, with a local enantiomeric excess psi, okay? And then there's some entropy of mixing, right, that favors having them together, right? And so you get this usual kind of entropy of mixing thing in the free energy. There's probably something which penalizes gradients of the chiral composition, okay? And it's suppose that's coupled to some other degree of freedom, omega, which represents something like the spin, right? As if it were equilibrium statistical mechanics, which it's not, okay? In that case, right, we would know just what to do, right? We would take the free energy and minimize it over the omega variable, and then plug that back into the free energy to get an effective free energy in terms of psi alone, which would look like this, okay? And then we would say, look, at some critical temperature, the coefficient of psi squared changes sign, and you can get a regular mean field symmetry breaking critical point, right? So a second order transition at this temperature, okay? So that's the equilibrium problem, right? So how do you get something like that in the active problem, right? That's what I'm trying to figure out, right? So I've got three cases to think about, okay? So case A, suppose that there is a zero-dimensional problem, right? A problem with just one individual spinner, right? That has an identity, which could be right-handed identity or a left-handed identity. And so it has one internal degree of freedom, which is psi. That's how much am I right-handed or how much am I left-handed, okay? And that is coupled just to the spin. In that case, I claim the only equations of motion that make sense to me would be something like this for the derivative of the spin and the derivative of the chiral identity of the individual unit, right? Where this piece, this looks like rotational viscosity, right? That is, if you have some spin, then it makes a torque opposed to the spin, right? So I can derive that from the dissipation function, no problem. Then there's some active spinning term, right? So this is like the torque term in the last problem, which I could derive in two different ways, right? So here, the same point, right? I can have something which is a driving torque, which tends to favor faster and faster rotation, right? And this is something which is proportional to the chiral order parameter, right? So that if the unit is right-handed, it wants to go one way. If the unit is left-handed, it wants to go the other way, okay? And then there can be an equation of motion for the chiral order parameter, okay? There is something here, right, which says that the chiral order parameter tends to get pushed towards zero, right? If it's positive, it has something which pushes it in a negative way or vice versa, which we can just derive from the entropy of mixing, right? This is just from the force corresponding to that piece of the free energy, okay? And then the only way I can have this argument make sense to me is to have another active spinning term in here, which is how the spin rate affects the chiral identity of the unit. So logically, to me, it seems that a term like this has to be there, but my problem is how to derive it from either a free energy or a dissipation function. Neither of those derivations make sense to me, right? Because I'd like to say that there is something in the dissipation function, a term in the dissipation function, that's like the rotation rate times the chirality, right, with some coefficient, like this, okay? And then I could take the derivative of that with respect to the rotation rate and get a term that belongs in this equation of motion. And now I really, really want to take a derivative of that with respect to this chiral order parameter, right, to get a term that belongs in the equation of motion for the chiral order parameter. But that's not what you do with dissipation functions. You're only supposed to differentiate dissipation functions with respect to velocities, not with respect to positions or other coordinates, right? So that's the conundrum that I'm confused about, and I would, of course, appreciate it if any of you happen to know the answer to that one. But if we suppose that this is true, right? Let's suppose you pretend this is true, okay? Then everything works, right? Then I can figure out the equations, whether the solution of the equations of motion goes to zero or not, right? I would just have a matrix there, and I can say, is the matrix positive definite or not? And at some critical point, the matrix goes from being positive definite to not, and at that point is a critical point where the chiral order parameter starts to grow randomly, right-handed or left-handed, okay? Was there a question, comments? Mm-hmm. No, right. Okay, so that's, I mean, that's the sort of trivial case, which is this zero dimensional with no conservation law. A more interesting case would be to say, what if you have a one-dimensional problem, say with a conservation law for the chiral particles, right? So that the time rate of change of this chiral order parameter, the enantiomeric excess, is the gradient of a current, okay? And the current comes from the gradient of a chemical potential for right-handed versus left-handed particles, okay? So this thing in the chemical potential would be something proportional to psi, the enantiomeric excess, comes from the entropy of mixing. And then there could be something else that's like a second derivative that comes from the gradient term in the free energy, right? So these two things are just like ordinary diffusion. And then by my mystery derivation, right, there has to be this extra piece that's proportional to the spin rate, okay? So if we believe that, okay, then the equations of motion have to be this old equation of motion for the spin, okay, plus this diffusion kind of equation of motion for the chiral composition, all right? And then to solve that, I would say, well, in the steady state for rotation, right, if the rotation can respond very rapidly to whatever is the enantiomeric excess, okay, then you get a rotation rate proportional to the enantiomeric excess, like that, okay? And then I can put that into here, right, in the second equation of motion. And if the coupling gets big enough or the temperature is low enough, right, then this term of negative something times psi will exceed this term of positive something times psi, okay? And so the overall coefficient of psi would change sign, okay? And then get an equation of motion like this one. And that's exactly what leads to spinodal decomposition, right? So we would solve this by saying, let's Fourier transform from position to wave vector. And then if, in that case, you know, this equation of motion gets a term that looks like positive q squared minus q to the fourth, right? And so that means there's some optimum wave vector where psi grows the most rapidly, right? That's the classical behavior in spinodal decomposition. And so it leads to a solution where both the chiral composition variable and the spin variable are growing exponentially, right? As exponential growth of positive something times time, times this cosine qx, where this is the wave vector that maximizes this thing in brackets, right? And so the picture you would derive from that is one here where there's a cosine wave in the chiral composition. And in the regions of one-handedness, you would have a counterclockwise rotation, right, with a max of rotation rate in the middle. And here in the regions of opposite-handedness, you would have the opposite rotation, again with the max in the middle. There's one more version of the model that I'll mention just briefly, and that is that I can put the flow velocity back in, right? So now this is a lot like this Yukatabe experiment that I was talking about in the first part of this talk, right? In that case, we now want to think about not just the spin rate, but the relative spin versus the rotational component of the flow, okay? And so now we have three equations of motion for the flow, the spin, and the chiral composition, okay? And this now does the same kind of thing as the previous case, where there's a spinodal decomposition and spinning within the spinodal. And then there is also a flow profile on top of that, okay? And so a flow profile, which is a sine wave rather than the cosine wave, right? So it's 90 degrees out of phase with the spin. And so it's a situation where you would get the maximum upward flow like this, as these guys are spinning outwards, right? And then the maximum spin where there is zero flow, okay? So that's something which I would claim looks like the simulation picture here, where it's the phase-separated fluid with different candidness components in each of the regions. Okay, so that's whoops, where's the end here? I've got one more slide somewhere. So the kinds of questions that I'm thinking about here, right? So I think that the theory goes partway towards modeling what's going on in that experiment and simulation, but with a couple of open questions that are on my mind, right? The very specific question is to justify the way that I introduced the driving into the second problem. I'm a little bit uncomfortable with that. I think it sort of works on a brute force basis, but I would rather have a better story about how to introduce those two terms for the driving and relate the coefficients of those terms. A second question, a much more general question than this, is that my story leading to spinodal decomposition, right? It works well because the phase separation is a second order transition, right? And so I can say that in the disordered phase, the equation of motion pushes everything towards the zero order parameter state, right? And in the ordered phase, the equation of motion pushes everything away from the zero order parameter state towards the symmetry breaking state, okay? That works great with the second order transition. I'm quite confused about how to deal with that if there were a first order transition, right? So what would happen if there were a system, say, that has, you know, a free energy profile as a function of some order parameter that looks like this? Well, I could say, so without the driving, let's suppose without driving, it looks like this, right? That the favored state is a disordered state, and then with driving, it looks like that, okay? So in equilibrium statistical mechanics, I know how to recognize that this is the stable phase because it's lower in free energy, right? But how do you even talk about that when you're not dealing with free energy, right? If there's an equation of motion, the equation of motion will say, well, this state is stable and this state is stable, right? But how do the equations of motion know that this state is more stable under some regime of parameters? So that's another question that I'm confused about, and I would greatly appreciate input from any of you about either of these points or anything else. And if you have any ideas, I'll buy you a cookie right after this talk. Right. So I'll stop here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, I'm not saying it's a solution, but the way you introduce your driving and the issues with it remind me of what's done in simulations. For example, if you couple something like a least effort bound with shear flow to a system regulated with, let's say, stress control or strain control, you have to deal with similar types of coupling functions, adding to Lagrangian similar kind of derivations or constraints, so this might be one place to look. I know also people set up with perturbations on the wave basis and try to couple them in.
Okay, I have fundamental problems with the variable omega. You called it a spin. If it's really a spin, it's fine. A spin is an additive quantity, so you can add up individual spins together to a spin. That's not true for this angular momentum, for this rotation. This omega depends on how many of these molecules you take to make an average. And if you take twice the volume, you don't get twice the omega. So that's not a really good macroscopic area. It's a problem always with this angular momentum. That's the reason, for instance, why if you look at Navier-Stokes equation, you have momentum conservation, energy conservation, mass conservation. There's a good reason that you don't have an equation for for angular momentum conservation, for exactly that same reason.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
But then you are referring to an ordinary fluid where you don't have spins. You do have spins in the way, right?
Is that a spin?
I mean, yeah.
The flow which you get for the spin doesn't matter.
In a regular fluid, the reason you don't have angular momentum conservation is simply because that's not an independent condition. So, you know, that's why you don't write it down, because it's already implicit in the other equations. Yeah. But if the system does have a spin degree of freedom, then you would write down something like this, I think. I don't see that this is a problem.
Okay. So, if you just straightforwardly don't use it as a forcing into the Stokes zone, the Stokes equation, then each molecule or each spin will add up to others.
If they only add up, it's okay.
Yeah.
But can I think of this capital omega as a Coase-Grand spin density?
I think so. I mean, that's
I think
how I'm trying to think about it, just as you think of velocity, is it? And there's a Coase-Grand velocity field.
Then the forcing in the Stokes equation will be proportional to it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And suppose you could solve Stokes equation with this forcing. And so you have the interaction between the spins.
You're talking about the hydrodynamic interaction.
Yeah,
sure. But people have looked at these kinds of things. Yeah.
So this chiral identity, is this something like a concentration, or is?
Yes. So in any local coarse grain region, there could be, say, 60 right-handed particles and 40 left-handed particles, right? So an excess of 20, right? And so it's the difference of concentrations between those two things. Right?
Did I understand it correctly that changing the chirality of these molecules would make them
you actually do produce particles for in one way or the other way. So this would be a realization of what you
in the experiment. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean that would be very, very nice because I've never seen something.
I don't have experimental proof. I mean, to the best of my knowledge, the experimenters have not tried the opposite, the mirror image molecules. But it has to be that way. I mean, that's you know, a very common kind of situation in liquid crystal physics is that you can make mixtures of right and left-handed molecules and tune the chiral properties in a continuous fashion. Yeah.
I don't know about these spinners, which you call it, but with respect to the first experiment of Tarle,
yes,
it's not true. It rotates this rotation even for compensated mixtures.
You mean an enantiomer?
Yes, an enantiomer. It doesn't change the rotation. It's more difficult than people believe. If you look into Deschenes' book, it's clear it has to change, but it doesn't. This is also experiments long time ago, 5 years, 8 years ago, in Paris. Experiments.
Well, that's more difficult than I believe.
Wait, so you change the chirality of the molecules, and the sense of rotation stays the same?
Yes, chirality and rotation sense is not there in any case.
So you're saying that it's nothing to do with the chirality then?
But can the flow just move left-handed particles in one way and the right-hand particles in another way? And this way it will separate.
You need to find what's the right kind of geometry for an experiment. I mean, normally flow doesn't do that, right? And so it's easier to see for this propeller-like rotation, right? How the same flow would induce opposite rotations. It's not obvious how it would induce different translations, but that's the challenge, is to create a situation where it does.
Experimentally, people seeing chiral liquid phase separation. That's the standard thing in crystals.
It's an unusual thing.
People have seen
it. But it has. It can happen.
Just, it might be such a small perturbation with a small molecule. With a larger molecule, it might be easier. So if you had left-handed or right-handed DNA, which you can synthesize, it might be a bigger effect. It might be a small effect. Yeah.
Right. And with the DNA, are you speaking about ZDNA or some other?
The people who make the opposite symmetry, it takes a bit of effort, but people have done that in the literature. So
No, but mirror image of BDNA.
Yeah, I mean, it's DNA is right-handed, is it? So you take a left-handed one as well, and because it's a lot longer, it'll amplify your chiral effect. So you always get magnified phase separation, polar rather than short.
Yes, so I want to just more general question. This also for the experts in the audience. Why the free energy? I mean, how do we actually know that it exists and that it's not just equations of motion, which indeed give me to my two stable points and I have no obvious way of telling which one is the lower one? Like, I know that for one of the active systems we created, which is just step of that part is without alignment, you can do a particular map to free energy under certain assumptions, which maps through the diffusion coefficient. Mm-hmm. But that's just one particular system. Why should this be generic?
That I don't know, right? The idea of the free energy, you know, works in equilibrium statistical mechanics. I don't think there is any guarantee that something like that works in non-equilibrium. Maybe under some circumstances there can be, you know, an effective free energy that does the job, but I think it's certainly not guaranteed. Yeah.
No, okay, so,
yeah. But this only is more like a system with an external force on it. In some sense, I mean, I don't know what the force is. You say it comes from gradient in humidity, so it's clearly complicated. So I don't know. I don't know what it is. But in some sense, I think it's more like a system with an external force. It's more like having, again, little magnets that are driven to rotate by a magnetic field or something like that, a suitable maybe AC magnetic field. Mm-hmm. In which case, I think you definitely you could write a free energy, you just have to actually pick up into some external force.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, going back to your, I don't really know this Lagrangian formulation you're describing here with this dissipation term and so on.
Mm-hmm.
But going back to your two ways of getting the forcing, I guess I would favor the theta because to me this is like
body force, like
it's like an external force.
Actually, I might very quickly comment on this. When you're doing simulation with oscillatory shear, if the coupling you introduce in the formalism is actually similar to it.
Okay.
I want to follow up on what Christina and Silke just said. The way that you were writing down, at least in the first part of the talk where you were introducing the tau water into your equations,
right.
You're introducing it like a body force. The way that I would think about it is that I have stuff falling under gravity, I have to put gravity into my hydrodynamic equations because there's a body force, there's a potential that I have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in the first part of the talk, the way that you were introducing the driving was as a body force, as something that everybody feels, like charge, electric field,
yeah,
charged particles or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But in the second part of the talk, when you were talking about the phase separation between rotors of opposite handedness, the driving is internal, right? In the sense that I'm driving at the shortest scale of my system, namely these guys are rotating.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason that the system is phase separating is that this micro driving has a macroscopic consequence that comes about all because of altered interactions between guys going this way and guys going that way, at least in the extruded volume case. I'm not sure that I can actually turn my head around starting at the top end, namely at the macroscopic scale, and figuring out what this consequence would be of the driving at the micro scale.
Right, so, you know, maybe, again, the first part of the talk is like, it's like comparing, you know, use of an active system, we think of it as the self-propelled colloids, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
What you're doing is more colloid sedimented under ground. Because they all have all colloids moving under an externally applied electric field because they're charged or something like that, okay, the first part. And if that is so, then why isn't there also a force, similar body force, if you like, on the second part as opposed to, again, as a panel said, it looks like an internal drive. I don't see how you change. Just because you have two types of charges, I still drive them with an electric field. They just up and go one way, up and go the other way.
Okay, so then it would be like positive and negative charges in an electric field.
Yeah.
Right?
I realize you're talking about things you're just in the middle of thinking about, and that's actually great, it's the right thing to do, but and I'm not saying I understand it, but I'm puzzled by these differences.
So I want to mention one other thing.
Please.
Given that we're talking about the smectic C monolayer system, what do you think about the system, again, Yukatabe's experiment, but older ones, where she has the smectic C monolayer, and what she does is she shines light so that the molecule becomes isotropic rather than rod-like. And so you have some transition rate between rod-like molecules and isotropic molecules.
Mm-hmm.
And basically that, what you have effectively at the end of the day is you have some Ginzburg-Landau type equation for the polar order of the smectic C. But in that Ginzburg-Landau theory, I'll have these, I don't know what you call them, but maybe A2 and A4, something that changes sign so that I get polar ordering, which will be a function of the concentration of molecules in my Langmuir trough. But that is now a reaction diffusion equation because of the light.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
that might be a simpler system to ask these same questions, right? Where it's not so complicated and there's no entity turning and swimming and so forth. Because it's very similar to the system that you're looking at, only it's a lot less messy because it's reaction diffusion in terms of what is happening with the driving. I don't know. I just wanted to see if you think that's the...
Well, I hadn't thought about that. That's a good suggestion. Thank you.
Sorry.
No, I was going to say, I suggest we continue the discussion at the by the cookies, if anybody has listen again.
Unless the other programs have already eaten them.
No, we should have a few minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.